Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests, so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Blake Percival, an Army veteran, former police officer, and 10-year employee of the U.S. Investigation Services, also known as USIS. USIS is one of the largest security clearance companies used by our federal government, tasked with vetting potential government employees who would have access to our nation's most vital secrets. Blake had consistently risen through the ranks of USIS until he discovered and exposed an internal secret. He has been called one of the most important whistleblowers in recent history and is the author of a new book entitled Holding On to Integrity and Paying the Price. He joins me today to share what it's like to be a whistleblower who was fighting for justice while scraping to make ends meet and fearing for his family's safety. Welcome to Deconstructed, Blake.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, before we get started, I should mention that today is the 157th anniversary of the False Claims Act, sometimes called the Lincoln Law, which imposes liability on persons and companies who defraud the federal government. And you have a lot of personal experience with that particular law, don't you, Blake?
Yes, I do.
How did a nice guy like you end up in a situation like that?
You know, I think just my background in the police field, the military, made me well suited for working in our government's security clearance background investigations.
Now, you consistently moved up the ranks all the way to director. What managerial qualities contributed to your success at USIS?
I was told that I had a way of interacting with the employees and winning them over to my way of thinking about things, moving roadblocks out of their way, and using technology to make their jobs easier.
Can you give me an example of what technology you used?
Sure. In the field, when I was the manager in Minnesota, I partnered with GE Fleet. We had company vehicles to use telematics or global positioning so that we could rapidly give an assignment to an investigator based on where they were in real time and if they were near an item that we needed to pick up. By doing that, it would save us on penalties. The government had timeliness requirements for these cases, and if USIS missed a timeliness deadline, there were hefty penalties to be made, and I was able to extrapolate out that this technology would save the company about $4 million a year.
Let's fast forward to 2011 when you took on a new role and things, shall we say, became interesting.
Yeah, that's putting it lightly. I'm very glad at that point in time that I could not see what was coming up in the road in front of me. In 2011, I was the district manager in Minnesota, and I was contacted and offered the director position for fieldwork services in Western Pennsylvania, where the national security background investigations were assimilated, reviewed, and delivered to the government.
What was your experience there?
So when I got there, it was the facility. It was 350 people in a 40,000 square foot facility. You know, I was told that I was being moved there because of my ability to interact with the employees. And they had some problems with attrition. When I got there, the company was losing 20% of their workforce in this area to competitors every year. And I was told that I was being moved there to address that problem and see if I could use innovative ideas with technology to streamline the processes.
And as I recall reading in the book, you had a methodology for doing that, which made total sense. And that was actually interacting with your employees. So let's talk about a particularly interesting conversation you had in that regard.
You know, anytime you want to find out the problems within an organization, if you just go one-on-one and talk with people, that's the best way to find them out. So what I did was I started having little group meetings with these 350 employees, and I would break them down, you know, five, six people in a meeting, and I would basically pose two questions to them. One, what do you like about your job? And two, what do you hate about your job? And by and large, I was getting the same type of answers from everybody. On the what do you like about your job, everybody was saying that they liked that USIS was a line of defense for the U.S. government, and that, you know, we helped protect the United States. And metaphorically, I could see them take out their American flag and wave it when they would answer that question. When I would ask, what do you hate about your job? The rank and file was giving me a list of things that I could fix. From my standpoint, it was minor stuff. It was potholes in the parking lot. It was dirty carpet. It was bare walls out in, you know, what I called Cubicle City, where you had 40,000 square foot of just cubicles. And so I began addressing the things that I could fix, and I began accentuating the things that they liked about their job. These meetings continued over several weeks. And when I was in about week three, maybe week four, it came to the point where I was going to meet with the two people that reported directly to me. If you can imagine a facility with 350 people in it that all were below me in the organization of this facility, I had two people that reported directly to me, then they had 8 or 10 people that reported to them, kind of like a pyramid.
Sure.
And on this particular day, it wasn't supposed to be anything special. I was going to share a cup of coffee with these two individuals and discuss what they liked about their job and what they hated about their job. And when I asked the question, what do you like about your job? I got the same answers that I had gotten from everybody else. You know, they liked that we had something to do with protecting America. And as soon as I said, what do you hate about your job? The female that was in this meeting immediately blurted out, I hate that we dump. And I didn't even know what dumping was. So I had her explain to me what dumping was. And I immediately said to her, we don't dump.
What is
dumping? Anybody tells you to dump. So dumping was a process that USIS came up with. Any business has a budget, and it's set up by the year and then by the quarter and then by the month of how much revenue they need to bring in and, you know, what their expenses are and everything. In this instance, USIS knew at the beginning of each month how much money they needed to generate. They knew how much they got paid per investigation when they delivered a case over to the U.S. government as, you know, we've investigated this person. And so as the end of the month approached, USIS, using a computer system that they had, would release cases to the U.S. government, regardless of where they were in the investigation process, just to meet that revenue number. If they knew that they had to release 5,000 cases in the last week of the month in order to meet that revenue objective, that's what they would do. And they would release these cases, whether the person had been investigated or not.
Wow. Well, the federal government almost always has an oversight process in place. So how in the world was USIS getting away with dumping?
Yeah, that's sadly funny also. So the U.S. government did have an oversight process. It required that, I think it was 4%, maybe 4.5% of the investigations that USIS was sending over were to be reviewed by the federal government. Well, the federal government did not have enough employees, so they put out a contract. They called it the support services contract, to hire a company to check the work that USIS was sending over. And they hired USIS to do that.
So they outsourced the audit process to the company that was being audited.
Yeah, kind of like putting the fox in the hen house.
Blake, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about how this situation began to unravel when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is Blake Percival, author of Holding On to Integrity and Paying the Price, and one of the most important whistleblowers of our time. Blake, once you made your management team aware of it, I'm assuming you did, what transpired and what was the sequence? Who did you tell first? How did they find out what was transpiring and what your attitude was towards dumping?
So, you know, I came from a law enforcement background, and I knew the most important thing to do immediately was stop it. And that's what I did. I did that by telling my subordinates that we don't do that anymore. And if anybody told them to do it, to direct them to me. The next thing that I did was, you know, I had just recently replaced someone that had held the exact same position I did. And within minutes of finding out about dumping, I had that person paged to my office, and I confronted them and asked them if they were aware of this process. And they looked at me with, you know, almost like the look that a child has if you catch them with their hand in the cookie jar when they're not supposed to be. But then what came out of this person's mouth was, well, if it hadn't been for dumping, nobody in USIS would have gotten a bonus last year.
Wow.
Which, yeah, it just kind of, you know, took away my faith in this company even further, you know, that it truly was all about the money. And so I had stopped the process. I had told my employees not to dump. And then things from upper management kind of accelerated with them trying to get me to dump. I began to get direct emails. I was pulled aside, you know, when we had a company meeting and was told that I needed to get with the person who I had just confronted about the dumping that had held my position before me and have them show me how to dump. And of course, none of that ever happened. And it was a pretty quick trip from we don't dump to Blake being terminated.
So you had integrity, and their approach was when they couldn't get you on the team to basically take you out of the organization. Did they give you any other option, or how did they address the issue of pushing you aside?
So I spent my life working in police work and investigations, and I'm familiar with the concept of if you want to get rid of somebody, you can find a reason. You can make up a reason. First thing you have to do is an investigation. So it all kind of kicked off with I had already had a pre-scheduled trip out to Denver, again, looking to use some technology and innovation to speed up a process that USIS did. While I was out in Denver handling that, two senior members of USIS's leadership team came to my facility and met with my employees. And, you know, they told me that they wanted to start these, what they call skip level interviews, where they interview not necessarily the person that works for you, but the person that works for the person that works for you. So they started their process, and I guess they did maybe a day and a half of interviews. And then the guy that had been sent in to do the interviews came in my office and told me that I was no longer needed.
Wow. And did they immediately offer you a package or any other type of job
option? They did. Yeah, so they offered me some choices. They told me that I could go back to an entry-level investigator job.
After 10 years.
And move anywhere in the country I wanted to. Of course, it would decrease my salary. The other option that they gave me was I could leave the company and they would give me a severance package. Severance package had some continuation of benefit, executive placement service, and it also had a monetary award of 20 weeks salary, which at the time for me was $42,000. I chose to leave the company, and they told me, at the time I was living in a corporate apartment. So I immediately had the problem of, you know, I've got to move immediately. And so they told me, go ahead and go home and start taking care of that kind of stuff. And they would get the severance package to me.
Now, when they got the severance package to you, was there any request to waive rights or like filing a False Claims Act case?
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. And it's the first time that whistleblower came into my thought process, you know, as far as the term. I went home and we moved everything into a U-Haul truck, and I set up a meeting with a lady from HR with USIS, and we met in a parking lot, and I was driving a U-Haul truck, and she got out of her car, I got out of the truck, and we met at the hood of the truck, and she handed me, it was a really thick severance package, all the paperwork, and she handed me a pen, and I looked at the severance package, and the first thing I noticed was that it had on the front page, in what I call legalese, you know, that print that's so small you can't hardly see it, but if you do take the time to read it, it's usually the most important stuff on the page.
Exactly.
And and so just in briefly looking at it, I noticed it had the word whistleblower, and I knew I needed legal counsel. And I had a friend back in Montgomery, Alabama that I had kept in touch with. He used to be a prosecutor when I was a police officer. So I called him and he said that if I would fax the paperwork over, he would take a look at it. So I faxed it to him. And almost immediately he called me and his question for me was, you know, why does your severance package have the word whistleblower in it? So I briefly started telling him, you know, what I had uncovered with dumping. And his advice for me was, don't talk to anybody, don't sign anything, protect your family and get out of there as quick as you can. And that's exactly what I did. And we kind of limped back to Montgomery, Alabama. And then I went to my friend, the lawyer's office, and met with him and more thoroughly explained what I had uncovered and what dumping was. And it didn't take him long to realize that, you know, this was a pretty big allegation and it would be a big case for a one-man law firm. So he took me across town to the largest law firm in Alabama. It's the Beasley Allen Law Firm. And I sat down with the guys at Beasley Allen, and I guess I spent about an hour laying out for them what was going on and that I had been fired and how, and I walked them through it all. And I'll never forget, at the end, I sat down, and the guy that ended up being my attorney, his name's Larry Golston. Larry stood up on the other side of the table, and he said, "Mr. Percival, what you've just described is classic whistleblower retaliation." But he said this, he was using a metaphor. He said, "But where are the bodies buried?" And I stood back up, and as I pulled a flash drive out of my pocket, you could actually see it looked like he had spit coming out the side of his mouth. He knew that I had the goods, and we began displaying that information on a computer that they had there. And I walked him through the dumping and showed him that I had the proof on it.
So as you were preparing to file a lawsuit, or your law firm was, you weren't able to get any severance, were you? Because you didn't accept the terms of the severance package.
That's true. And when I talked to people about whistleblowing and about my case specifically, basically, in order for me to file my case, it cost me $42,000. And I vividly remember when we ended up settling in my favor and there was a multimillion dollar award, laughing with my attorney that, you know, when this all started, all I was really worried about was my $42,000.
Well, you were worried about your family too. Wasn't there a black SUV outside your home and so forth?
Yeah, that's true. We had actually several years of constantly looking over our shoulder. Not that that ever really ends for a whistleblower, but there was an incident in Montgomery where we were obviously being surveilled.
And you also, since you had to, in effect, start over again, you were working multiple jobs just trying to keep food on the table.
That's true. And kind of the way it happened for me is, you know, I lost a six-figure job in the investigations industry. Nobody really wants you to work in the investigations business if you've been at a high level and were fired, and you can't even tell them why you were fired. So I found myself back in Montgomery, Alabama, working at an entry-level investigator job. We're also at the same time working as a magistrate on midnight shift and then stocking grocery shelves.
Wow. Well, Blake, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about what transpired after you filed your lawsuit when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is Blake Percival, an incredibly important whistleblower and the author of Holding On to Integrity and Paying the Price, which, by the way, just released today. And thank you for doing that on our show. I really appreciate that, Blake. Now, let's talk about what happened after you filed the lawsuit. When did you file and what transpired? Kind of give me the chronology of how it unfolded, how quickly or slowly it unfolded.
So I filed my case July 1st of 2011. And as is required in whistleblower cases, it was filed under seal. And at that point, the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Alabama was briefed on the merits of the case. So July 1st of 2011, the federal government knew what I was alleging, and they knew who I was, that I had been the director of the facility that I was saying was doing this. So the federal government began investigating my claim, and 60 to 90 days later, they came back and they asked me for a continuance to continue investigating the claim and keep it under seal. Initially, that made perfect sense. It was a big thing that I was alleging, and I knew they had to investigate it. And anyway, they continued every 60 to 90 days to ask for these continuances. And that was getting old, and it was especially getting old since we were struggling to get by financially. So that continued until June of 2013. And in June of 2013, a guy named Edward Snowden fled from the United States, taking with him a hoard of NSA classified data. And USIS had done Edward Snowden's background investigation. Well, Congress began holding hearings about this security failure, about, you know, security clearances, and Edward Snowden was brought up in these hearings. And right on the heels of that, in September of 2013, a guy by the name of Aaron Alexis went to the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., murdered 12 people and committed suicide. And it immediately came out that USIS had done his background investigation.
Wow.
So two monumental failures in our security clearance process, and they both were laid at the feet of USIS. Congress was holding hearings about it, and, you know, so that kind of pushed the DOJ to take action on my case. It came up on the floor of Congress that the OPM Inspector General, when being asked if he had a problem with the investigation that was done on Edward Snowden, he didn't exactly answer that question. But what he said was that he had a problem with the company that conducted the investigation because they had been under investigation since 2011. And I remember hearing that on C-SPAN, and it was probably the first time I'd ever watched C-SPAN on purpose. And I remember kind of doing a fist pump in the air, because this was the first time I had a glimmer of hope that they were doing anything with my case. And it, like I said, it kind of pushed their hand. That was September of 2013. And then lo and behold, in October of 2013, the Department of Justice officially intervened in my case. And what intervening is it means that they believed my allegations, and they believed that they could prove them in a court of law. So they took over the case, and it changed from Blake Percival versus USIS to the United States government ex rel Blake Percival versus USIS.
And at that point, your name was no longer under seal. The case wasn't under seal, correct?
That's true. And they had told me from the beginning that at some point my name would be released because I'd be required to testify. So they released my name, and quite honestly, all that did was make living harder. You know, now I had all the major news agencies finding me. Some of them found me at work in the middle of the night, and I couldn't talk. I was prevented from talking, which, you know, was another shocking thing for me about being a whistleblower. Everybody else was talking about my case, even Congress, and they never called me to talk about it. As the whistleblower, I felt like I was the only one that couldn't talk about it.
Wow. So your case started in July of 2011. I know, because I've seen some of the DOJ reports, that the alleged fraud continued for over a year. They continued to get contracts at USIS. I think at one point they actually consumed 67% of OPM's contract spending for the fiscal year. So they were fat, dumb, and happy moving forward. But it finally came to a head in December of 15. Tell me a little bit about the resolution of the case 4.5 years after it started.
Yeah, so it drug on a lot longer than I thought it would. And USIS had tried some legal maneuvers. And what it finally came down to was USIS decided to file bankruptcy. And they filed bankruptcy, which, looking back on it, was a really boneheaded move, because the federal government controls bankruptcy court. So USIS filed bankruptcy, and the United States attorney went into bankruptcy court and objected to the bankruptcy, and basically said that USIS was filing bankruptcy on illicit earnings from fraud, and you can't do that. So in the bankruptcy court, they worked out a settlement to settle the case, and they settled it for just a little over $30 million.
Wow. You know, with all of the attention that whistleblowers have gotten in recent months, were there any members of Congress in particular who helped you or maybe even hurt you?
There were none. Well, here's what I found out real quick. Members of Congress would highlight my case or talk about my case if it helped what they were trying to do. None of them genuinely seemed to take an interest in it. I do remember that on the particular day that I was watching C-SPAN, Daryl Issa talked. And I remember a statement that he made. Now, you know, think about everything me and my family had gone through, and I'm sitting there getting a glimmer of hope because they're talking about my case, and Daryl Issa makes the comment in Congress that he's not sure somebody that CC'd on a memo deserves a whistleblower award. I was devastated and blown away by that comment, and always thought that Mr. Issa should have just said thank you for the information I'd brought to the government.
Just out of curiosity, did Adam Schiff try and protect your anonymity?
Not at all.
Oh, well. Hey, what's life been like after finally settling your case? What are you doing now?
So, you know, I took some time with my family. We bought an RV. We traveled for a year. Then we moved to the beach. We lived on the beach for a couple of years. I, of course, took time to write my book. What better place to write it than on the beach? And I've done a little bit of work with a law firm out of Washington, D.C. It's Protect Us Law. I was fascinated to join that law firm. It was interesting. They approached me because my story has a lot of bells and whistles that are interesting to people. And they thought that they could use my story to reach other whistleblowers. And I've allowed them to do that. And as such, I've joined that law firm as a member.
Excellent. Well, Blake, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and get a copy of your new book, Holding On to Integrity and Paying the Price?
So I'm on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Persigator, P-E-R-C-I-G-A-T-O-R. My website, if you want an autographed copy of the book, is blakepercival.com. If you go there and order a book, I'll sign it for you and send it to you. The book's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And then, you know, like I was describing earlier, I went through some hard financial times while I was trying to do the right thing. And so in response to that, I've started a nonprofit. It's Whistleblower Assistance Fund. And if anybody's interested in finding out more about that, you can go to whistleblowerassistancefund.org. Read all about it.
Well, that's terrific, Blake. I wish you every success with your new book, Holding On to Integrity and Paying the Price. It's a fascinating read, and I have to admit, somewhat disturbing glimpse into our nation's security system and the challenges that face a whistleblower. Thank you again for doing the right thing for our country, and thanks again for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you for having me.